call your mommy, your daddy, and all your friends and tell them New York's number one podcast app is blowing up the airwaves and they can't do nothing about it. Bashani Radio app. We global, baby.
Yeah, baby!
Download free for iPhone and Android in the App Store.
This is David Spradley, and you should check out Z, the SEO queen.
Do you have an online business or want an online business but lack the team or the expertise to get on Google page one? Did you know that 33% of all Google search traffic clicks the first result only? Do you want to get more traffic to your website, social media profile, or just want your video to get more hits or go viral? Well, you need to contact the SEO Queen Digital Marketing Agency, where you are more than just a number. You can't lose with the SEO Queen. More visibility, more credibility, more profitability. Visit theseoqueen.net for more information. That's theseoqueen.net. theseoqueen.net. That's theseoqueen.net.
Hello, this is Lady Z, a violinist. I'm coming to you because I want to encourage you to get your copy of Elevate. It's available on Apple Music and iTunes, Amazon, and Google Play. So if you're listening to this on your computer or your cell phone, whether you have an Android or an iPhone, you can get your copy of this song, this show's theme song, by just going to Apple Music, Amazon, or Google Play and get it today. I appreciate your support. Thank you.
This is David Spradley, and you're listening to The Jazz and Tech Lounge with Lady Z.
Jazz and Tech Lounge with Lady Z, a podcast about the secrets of success in technology, music, and business on Bashani Radio, iHeartRadio, and iTunes. Bashani Radio, always talking about everything from New York City. You can listen to the Jazz and Tech Lounge with Lady Z on any mobile phone or tablet device. The Jazz and Tech Lounge with Lady Z, where we explore tech and enjoy the music and learn the secrets to music and technological success. Please follow us online at www.ladyz.com and on all social networks at Lady Z. Please pull out your phone and follow me on Instagram at Lady Z. So I am so excited for my next guest because this is for a multitude of reasons. So I'm excited because this man was probably at one point co-workers with my uncle, who was retired LAPD. And I'm also excited because I believe he's doing the Lord's work, helping to exonerate wrongfully convicted people. And I think that's very, very important. I'm excited about this interview because he is truly an expert who's expertise is germane to this time that we're living in, especially post George Floyd. So my next guest is Timothy Williams Jr. He's a 29-year retired senior detective supervisor from the Los Angeles Police Department. He retired from the elite robbery homicide division. And during his time with the LA Police Department, he completed over 26 years of various detective assignments and conducted supervising, including not limited to robbery, homicide, domestic violence, child abuse, rape, sexual assault, juvenile and narcotic investigations. Now, another interesting thing about him is that he also worked within internal affairs during his tenure with the LAPD. And he is known nationally as an expert in use of force, wrongful conviction, police procedure, and more. He has been featured as a commentator for police procedure and use of force on radio, cable television, Fox News, World News, Good Morning America, CNN, Inside Edition, and 2020. So I would like to present to some and introduce to others, Timothy Williams Jr. How are you today, sir?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I'm doing wonderful.
Great. I'm so glad you had time to come and share your expertise with everyone here at the Jazz and Tech Lounge.
Wow. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
So I want to know, what made you want to become a police officer?
Well, you know, I was, my focus was the medical field. When I was in the military, I was attached to the medical corps. I was a clinical laboratory technician. And I studied at Fort Sam, Houston, Texas. And after we graduated, I graduated from lab school, I was assigned to Walter Reed. And I specialized in hematology, focusing on malaria studies. And I did
I did that.
And I was the commanding officer there, let me moonlight in a community hospital where I was the chief lab tech at the community hospital in the evenings. And I did all matters of exams as relates to laboratory technology. Mm-hmm. I left the military, and then I worked at a local community hospital, working histology section, mm-hmm. a study of tissues.
And,
in my building where I was living, there were police officers, and they were bugging the heck out of me about, hey, man, you should join this, join the department, and all this other stuff. So to get them off my back, I took an exam. I didn't know I didn't have to take the exam because I had, you know, college credits at that time. Mm-hmm. And I passed. And 3 months later, I was in the academy.
And oh, wow.
It was my background. My background investigation was quick, I guess. And I was in the academy. And I said, if I'm going to do this, then there are certain things I want to do. And I want to become an investigator, go into investigation. So, and that's what I did. I almost didn't see my career through after about 2 years. I was ready to quit.
Why were you ready to quit?
Dealing with the racism of the department.
Oh, wow.
I bring the issues to the commanding officers, and they did nothing. And I was getting ready to quit. I was talking to a colleague of mine whose father was a captain, didn't know that, and we were, and I was in line getting to qualify on a night shoot, and his father says, you know, induced himself to me, and he gave me his card. Says, give me a call the sergeant tomorrow, and I did, and I got selected to work employee opportunity and development division, and then I, you know, obviously I stayed. And. And my likeness was used for LAPD recruitment for about 11 years. And I have that poster in my conference room in my office now. And I did 29 years, and here I be.
Wow, that's incredible. So what? Because, you know, before I get into, you know, the use of force and police procedure, I want to, you normally I ask this question at the end of the interview, but I'm going to ask this now. What are the three things that you you see that contributed to your success in, you know, dealing with the racist LAPD department?
Well, the first thing was the core values my mother and father taught me as a child. I bought those core values within the department. My father taught me from a child, always, you know, be up front and down front, but make sure that you do your homework. And you know, stand up for yourself and don't take nothing from anyone. And you know, my mother said, don't ever let anyone tell you what you can't do. My mother's first generation American. And she, you know, my family is from, my mother's side is from the Caribbean, Barbados and Trinidad. And so I had the Caribbean Southern upbringing. My father's from Greenville, Mississippi. And so I had that type of upbringing. And so my core values were in place, and my core values never changed. In other words, I never took on the culture of law enforcement. And that's very hard to do for any profession. A lot of times people get into professions and the profession defines them. I worked very hard to let that happen to me. And I always encourage others, you know, to be who you are and whose you are. And you'll never go wrong. The second thing is that, you know, I dealt with issues as they come up, as far as what I did on the department. I did things that caused a lot of discomfort instead to the status quo, but it benefited a lot of blacks who came behind me. And the third thing is that I never let, you know, anyone say what I couldn't do on the department. I worked at the highest level in the department, at the chief's level, as an adjutant. An adjutant's aide as an aide to the commanding officer. And I wasn't a gatekeeper. Because those positions are very powerful. And I made changes within the organization in my sphere of control. And it helped a lot of people get promoted and be in positions they wouldn't have been if I wasn't there.
That's awesome.
So these are things that I've done, even those at the higher level where mm-hmm. I was at. And a lot of folk don't know how they get there. And I just smile. And I said, I know how you got there because I was there when it happened. So the thing is that, you know, I was been blessed. I've been in some very intricate positions. And one of the things that I'm very proud of, I created the domestic violence program for LAPD.
Okay.
Under Chief Willie Williams, he thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. He approved my proposal. I ran the pilot program for LAPD, and they reorganized the detective function in 1994. The first time in 50 years that the detective function was reorganized.
Wow.
And now they have a major, at that time they had to put in a major assault crimes unit, which is the domestic violence unit. And when I was adjutant at Detective Services Group, I was a domestic violence expert, hate crimes expert, and immigration expert. And I lectured to foreign delegations, and I represented the department in its domestic violence efforts on statewide committees that was focused in Sacramento. So I've done a lot. I left a legacy on the department, and it's a story to be told.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, as a use of force and police procedure expert, I mean, you revamped the detective function. You worked in internal affairs. You worked in the homicide division. I mean, you've worked in all the departments that any movie we see about the police, the departments that are highlighted. So what would you say is like your biggest accomplishment, you know, since you've retired and started your own company?
Well, my biggest accomplishment is being able to level the playing field to the point where individuals were able to get their freedom after being incarcerated for 20, 30 years. People were found not guilty in some of the cases I worked on, and if I wasn't on those cases, they would have been found guilty, and they would have been in prison for decades for crimes they didn't commit. So my thing is that my job is to level the playing field, and when I'm in court, I'm an expert as a teacher. I'm not an advocate, and my job is to teach the jury that I'm testifying before, my testimony will assist the judge in making meaningful rulings as they come up during the court hearing, and that's my job. And to get to the point where I'm testifying in court is a lot of work, a lot of hours, a lot of hard work and study. And you know, that's the unglamorous work, if you will.
So can you walk us through what that work looks like? Are you looking at police reports, pouring through evidence?
Yeah. When I get a case, let me start with the criminal work first. Okay. When I get a case, I request that the retaining attorney give me everything on the file, and that could be from one binder to 10 binders worth of paperwork. It's called discovery. And as I look at things, I request additional things as it relates to policies. I want to proceed policy procedures. If it's an aged case, when I say aged, an old case, I want the policies that were in place during the time of the incident. I don't want to look at the policies now because that's irrelevant. You want to know what the policies were at the time of the incident. You want to, there's certain things you ask for administratively, and then I sit down and I study. I take notes, copious notes, and I study, and I consult with the attorney from time to time, and I give my advice, and I, you know, my suggestions, and a lot of times they give me suggestions, and I tell them, you know, I can't testify about that, you know, that's, you know, that will destroy my credibility, but this is what I can do for you. And you've got to be, you know, you got to give them the good, bad, and the ugly about the case. On the civil rights side, I do the same thing. And, but, you know, the thing that I tell the attorneys when I lecture, I tell them that you need to get your experts early in the case. And the reason why is that, because in federal cases, they have, I call them sunset dates, where you can no longer ask for certain things, that you can't bring people into the lawsuit, and the discovery or the things that you request are very critical, and those dates are closed. And I'm appointed or I'm retained after all that. I can be of help, but I can't be of critical help that you need. And if I'm reading a case, and I'm saying that, well, this is a supervision issue or a detective issue or a patrol issue or whatever the case may be, and you don't have these players into the lawsuit, well, guess what happens? You just lost your case. And, you know, and
wow.
So the thing is that you've got to get your experts on earlier. And it's going to cost attorneys money. And that's the bottom line. And if you don't have the fiscal resources to do civil rights cases, then you shouldn't be doing them, because those are expensive cases, and you've got to get your experts on board early. It's going
when
to cost
you say expensive. What are you talking about?
Well, when I say expensive,
like for a case, I'm just like overall.
Oh,
like
I you know, for my time, you know, my time is it costs. You know,
right? I know your time costs. Yeah. I'm just curious about the total cost of.
There's other experts as well that you can.
Right.
And just besides myself, and I may recommend, I say, hey, you may need a DNA expert, or you may need a ballistics expert here to assist, or an audio visual expert. And all these experts add up after a while. But
yeah,
this is what you need to put your civil rights cases on. On the criminal side, you need the same thing. But guess what happens? You know, you have experts on a Superior Court panel. So you can get those put into the case. And the court, you have court-approved rates, and then you have your private rates, which is totally different than the court-approved rates. So, you know, if it's a court-appointed case, then I advise the attorneys to get certain people appointed on the case so that we can, you know, put together, quote-unquote, that dream team, if you will.
Right.
And the community needs to know that. You may not have the money on the criminal side to do things, but you can still get that dream team because there's experts that you can get through the court and get appointed, and they can help you with your case.
Yeah, that's good to know. So what inspired you to write your book, A Deep Dive?
Well, there was concerns that I saw. And there were, you know, there was always people asking me, well, what is it that you do? And so I decided, instead of keep on chewing the same cabbage over and over again, I decided to sit down and write. I've always wanted to write, and I sit down and write. I wrote, and I'm starting my second book now.
What's your second book about?
It's going to be I'm doing a deep dive series.
Okay. Because your first book is A Deep Dive in Expert Analysis of Police Procedure, Use of Force, and Wrongful Conviction.
Right. And my next deep dive is going to be about solutions. We can always talk about the problems, but no one ever talks about solutions.
So what do you think are the solutions to the racism and the police brutality? I mean, I've been hearing about officers being caught planting drugs on people. And all kinds of, Breonna Taylor. I mean, the police report was blank.
Yeah. So. Well, yeah. I don't know. I don't know what all that's about. But the thing is that the first thing is leadership. You got to have ethical leadership, and I see that for the most part absent from the criminal justice system, and. And then you got to bring in the proper people. You have people doing background investigations who are retired police officers, and they bring in the same mentality that it was when they were there. So you'll never see no change. So, you know, that, and I call them gatekeepers. You got to bring people in with core values. There's two core values that are critical. You got one. Is a reverence for life, and the second one is respect for individuals. And those are, to me, those are the benchmarks for of core values. And if you get that into the system, then the rest of the stuff will become not so much easy, but you can work and train and constantly guide and direct throughout individuals' careers to have a different police department than what you have now.
Wow. So, man, since you started your company, I know that you have an accomplishment. You were able to help the guys in Chicago. What did you call them? The Inglewood?
Inglewood 4. That's Englewood 4. Inglewood 4.
So for those who aren't familiar with what happened with the Inglewood 4, how did they get wrongfully convicted?
Well, I'll give you the Cliff Note version of it. They were teenagers at the time. It was a rape and murder. And they picked up a group of black kids, and basically they were coerced into confession. The system ratified the bad detective work, and the prosecutorial work was just as bad, and when they got to court, they were convicted as teenagers, and they spent, I think, a little over 20 years in prison for a murder that they didn't commit.
Wait, what?
Yes.
20 years?
Yeah, a little bit over. And
wow.
The person that was, and this is textbook stuff, the person that committed the murder was at the crime scene when the investigators were doing the investigation, and they had interviewed him up to a point, but they didn't do a thorough interview of him. And if they had done a thorough interview and done a proper investigation, those kids, an ethical investigation, let me put it like that, those kids wouldn't have spent those decades in prison.
So you're telling me that somebody on the scene kind of made up in their mind who did what?
Well, no, they didn't. They weren't made up on the scene. It was that there was a very poor investigation. If you read if you study investigations, you find that a lot of times, especially suspects of violence where shots are being fired and folk have been hit, suspects sometimes return to the crime scene as observers. And in this particular case, the suspect was at the crime scene when the detectives were doing their investigation. He was interviewed, and there was some discrepancies in what his story was, and they never followed through on it. So as science progressed, they re-examined the evidence and through via DNA, and they found out their DNA wasn't there, but the person that was at the crime scene, his DNA was there.
So you were able to guide the defense attorneys, and basically, you know, when the case was reopened, you were able to make that suggestion for a DNA expert to reanalyze.
No, that was done. That was all that stuff was done before I got the case.
Remember,
this was a civil rights case.
Gotcha.
Oh, this wrongful conviction. Now, these guys were suing for wrongful conviction, and then I came on the scene.
Okay, that makes sense. So, I mean,
this was through the Innocence Project out of Chicago.
Oh, okay, the Innocence Project. I have heard of that. But for those who haven't heard of the Innocence Project, can you explain what that is?
Yeah, the Innocence Project. Well, I've done work with. I started with. In this project in New York with, you know, the founders were there are Barry Scheck. You know, Barry Scheck was one of the instrumental attorneys in the O.J. Simpson case, speaking of DNA.
Right.
And Peter Neufeld. Mm-hmm. And then Northeastern, or Northwest, I think, is law school is in Chicago. And the law school was instrumental, and the law students were instrumental in doing the work to get these gentlemen out of prison. And then when they were suing, I worked with the Innocence Project with that law school. And I do work with the Innocence Project here in Los Angeles, Loyola Law School as well. So, you know, I've do a lot of work with the Innocence Project. There's Innocence Project programs throughout the country, and a lot of them are embedded in law schools.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they do. They, you know, I mean, there's so much wrongful conviction that goes on. And I can tell you, I get about anywhere from 5 to 10 calls a week from across the country about wrongful conviction.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. 5 to 10 a week
a
from
week.
Different attorneys on different court cases.
Majority of them are down south, deep south.
Do you get any calls from Mississippi?
Yep.
Yeah, that's one state that I definitely avoid. I fear going in that state because I really don't trust the powers that be.
Well, I have family in Mississippi, and they tell me that, especially in Greenville, that the Klan is still prevalent as it was back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and they're still there today, as I'm told, and this is 2020.
Wow. It blows my mind that people teach hate.
Well,
over,
you know,
generations, and think there's nothing wrong with that.
What you see in coming out today is nothing new. It's just it is coming out from under the sheets, no pun intended.
Right. And, you know, from a biological aspect, you know, I think Trump is proving that, you know, epigenetically, he's predisposed to some pretty racist things.
Well, America has their own self to blame for that because America put them in office.
Right. This is true.
And those who didn't vote have themselves to blame too.
Yep. So, you know, this is just awesome. Like, how do you think your training as like a lab tech prepared you for, you know, what you do today as an expert witness?
Well, my exposure in the medical field has you know, I'm aware of a lot of things that can be and should be. In that, you know, I've studied, become a lab tech, a clinical lab tech, you have to take courses in like in parasitology, hematology, blood banking, bacteriology, pathology, and all those chemistry, and all those issues that are in the clinical field. And so I have an idea of what, you know, because this was, I mean, some of the best training I had was in the military. I mean, you can't get, you just the training that I had, you couldn't get it in civilian environment.
Right, right.
And then, or even in the professional schools, because the hospitals had equipment that they didn't know how to operate. And we were trained, we were trained in that. And that's what made me so marketable when I was in D.C., because I had the training that the schools weren't, the civilian schools weren't teaching.
Right.
So the thing is that, you know, and then I bring that same knowledge base into my investigations. Science is very critical in criminal investigations. Science is very critical in civil rights investigations. And you've got to know how to not take the answers, but go back and look at how they got the answers, if you understand what I'm saying.
Right. To look through, you know,
yeah,
just
make sure,
every
make
single
sure what
step.
They're saying is correct.
Right.
Yeah. Let me give you an example.
Yeah, I would love to hear a couple of examples.
Yeah. This is in my book.
Mm-hmm.
The example I'm gonna give you now. I had a case. It was a young man was arrested for murder in a drive-by shooting. The DA said that his DNA was on the gun. So, you know, that's damning evidence.
Yeah, that is.
That's damning evidence. No, so I'm studying the file. I'm seeing a little bit of issues here, a little bit of issues there. But it's nothing to get over that DNA hump. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. I'm following you.
Now, I suggested to the defense attorney that we need to get a DNA expert to look at the science. So we went back and forth, and he finally agreed with me that we would do that. So we went to the court, and the court appointed a DNA expert. Now, this is what a court-appointed DNA expert, okay? The family didn't have to pay for this. The court, the county paid for this. State paid for it. And so we hired him. He was hired, and he looked at the charts, and he says, "Hey Tim, you know, this looks good." I says, "No, I need you to, you know, do a deep dive. I need a deep dive." So, you know, I do a lot of training, and every year I go up. I do about 20 to 40 hours of continuing education every year.
Oh wow! So
I always go to DNA lectures.
Oh, okay.
I always go to DNA lectures. So I said, this is what I want you to do. I want you to study the electropherograms and the electropherograms, those are the charts with squiggly marks on them that gives you, I'll give you some of the alleles and loci. The alleles are your markers and the loci is at different levels of your DNA prototype. It
right.
goes up. So I want to see if those charts comport with real science. And then I want you to look at, you know, the rough notes and the bench notes and the samples and the logs of the samples. So he went and he said, well, he said, they he said the electric fairgrounds, there are a lot of stutter marks on there, and it's not true science. I said, now we're getting somewhere. And so the district attorney was saying didn't comport to what the electric fairgrounds said. Second thing we found, the samples got mixed up.
Oh, wow.
And so
the chain of possession got
mixed up.
Oh, man, that's horrible.
Yeah. And not only was the electric fairgrounds faulty or didn't come to scale, it was other marks, but the samples got mixed up. Long story short, the jury found the defendant not guilty. Now, if we had and I talked as a chapter, and then there I said, do not stipulate, I tell attorneys, don't stipulate to anything as it relates to investigations and science. Do not stipulate. So they, and so if we didn't do that deep dive, that young man would have been sent to prison for life for a murder he didn't commit.
Wow. Wow.
True case.
Man. So sometimes it's not even like deliberate sabotage. It's incompetence.
Well, you got to go. If you don't dig, you won't know. You won't find.
Wow.
And you know, the district attorney's office should have done that. But obviously they didn't do it.
Uh-huh.
Or if they did and didn't share it with the defense side, shame on them.
Right.
But this is what we found.
Wow, that's shocking.
Yeah.
Shocking, but not shocking.
Yeah. Another case. I gave you shocking, more shocking. A young man was sitting in the corner on a phone. The officer, a black young man.
Mm-hmm.
Officers approach him, arrest him for robbery. For you know, because he was described as a robbery suspect in a robbery report. And and then you know, so I get the case and I'm looking at it and I requested some videos from a video surveillance from the area where he was at, and they found it and show us his arrest. And I see a lot of blood on the ground. And I says, okay. So let me put a comma here, but I want to see the robbery report that connects this guy to it. Well, I get the robbery report. It has a male black. I'm going to give you some descriptions, 5'9", 5'10", 120, 130 pounds. No tattoos. This kid has tattoos all over his face. Doesn't even fit the description of the suspect. So that's one thing. The second thing is I want to know what caused all this blood to be on the scene. So I had the video enhanced. It come to find out that when I say enhanced, I had the video slow down so I could see what was going on, because you can't see in real time. The officers kicked this young man in the face two or three times, in the face with their boots, and thus, you know, causing blood to be on all over the place. So I talked about the use of force.
Mm-hmm.
I talked about the police procedural aspect of it and the fact that he doesn't even fit the description of this case as a suspect in this case. I wrote a very detailed report, and my report settle that case where the DA dropped the charges. Well, the first thing, that case should never have been filed. Why did I have to go through all this stuff to doing the DA's job? The DA should have known better. Are you following what I'm saying?
Yes, I am.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So these are the things that I have to deal with, not only in the local but the national level.
Wow.
And, go ahead.
So when you take on, you know, a national case, because I know your office is based here in LA, do you get on a plane and go on location?
If I have to testify, yes.
Okay. Okay.
If I have to testify, yes. I've testified in Arizona, I've testified in New Mexico, I've testified in Florida. And, you know, so wherever I'm needed, I go.
So use of force, 1992, Rodney King. You know, you said earlier that was a come to Jesus moment. Why haven't we seen more repentance or policy change? And what have been your most notable use of force cases?
All my use of force cases are notable because it's force that doesn't have to be utilized, and that's why I'm on the cases. There are cases I could talk about, but I can't because they're in the courts right now, and that are use of force. To answer your question, in 1992, there was a clarion call saying that it's time for reform, and that clarion call lost its voice, and nothing's really changed. 27 years later, you get the same clarion call on the post George Floyd. And I'm cautiously optimistic. I'm not at all 100% optimistic. I always look at the glass half full.
Right.
But I know the environment, and I know this system, and I know how certain incidents invigorate certain responses. George Floyd was a worldwide response.
Yes, it was. Absolutely.
And I've done interviews in Canada. I've done Canadian media. I've done interviews with from China, with the Chinese media. Even had a mural of George Floyd in Syria. So, you know,
yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. So, you know, it's got worldwide notice, but I call this, as we talked about earlier, the altar call syndrome. What do I mean by that? You go to church and you hear a very rousing sermon, and the pastor opens the doors to the church for folk to come down and make a commitment to change their life. Well, a lot of times I would say about 80% of it is emotional. They come down and they never experience that conversion experience. And they leave the church doors and they're the same, they're the same heathen as they were before they walked down before they walked down the aisle. Now, the same thing happens when you have these type of issues, the Rodney King issues and the George Floyd issue. We have all this demonstrations, and we need reform. We need to defund police. Need to do this and do that. But after that, is that all emotion without the commitment for reform? Or is this just the altar call syndrome where you go out there and as time passes, it quiets down and the same is business as usual? The thing is that reform is a Goliath challenge.
And it requires more than just a passing interest. It requires a long-term commitment.
Thank you very much. And you got to have the right people at the table. The stakeholders. What I mean by stakeholders, the people in the community. You have the business community that has to be at the table for reform. The educational system has to be at the table for reform. The faith community has to be at the table for reform. Law enforcement has to be at the table for reform. The judges have to be at the table for reform. Department of Corrections has to be at the table for reform. Probation and parole has to be at the table for parole. And I'm talking about both federal and state. The prosecutorial arm has to be at the table for reform.
Mm-hmm.
The defense bar has to be at the table for reform. The plaintiff's bar has to be at the table for reform. Department of Family and Children's Services has to be at the table for reform. That's the criminal justice system. All players in the criminal justice system have to be at the table for this reform. Now, these agencies, I am not at all desirous of seeing leadership at the table, because if leaders were change agents, there wouldn't be a need for reform because they would be reform already.
Yeah.
You see, so I want the rank and file representation at the table. Yeah, you may have some leadership there, but my focus is on rank and file. Because they're out there doing the job. They know what the issues and concerns are, and they will make the changes. You see. So
right.
I look at, law enforcement, the changes that have been made. They didn't come from the top. They didn't come from the chief. The DARE program came from a police officer. The domestic violence program on LAPD, that came from the detective. Yours truly, Tim Williams.
Right.
I wasn't the chief, but the leadership wasn't even thinking about that.
Right.
And I got pushback on that from the leadership.
Wow.
Until Williams came.
Mm.
Then when Williams got there, it was done. But it benefited the community. Big time.
So I have a question for you. De-escalation, do you see more police departments rolling out de-escalation programs, training programs?
Well, let me tell you about de-escalation.
Yes, please tell me. Give me your professional breakdown.
De-escalation, I learned about de-escalation when I was in the military during the Vietnam conflict, where during basic training, they talked about de-escalation. We were trained in that area. That was in the 60s. When I came on the department in 74, de-escalation was taught. De-escalation is not new. It's not new. It's just not practiced. So, all this stuff that the public think is new, it's not new. It's been around for decades. For decades. But it hasn't been practiced. So the thing is that it's the issue of training. You got to get supervisors off behind the desk, out in the field, to become supervisors where you guide, direct, and lead. And you perhaps wouldn't have seen a George Floyd situation if you had a supervisor on scene.
Right.
All right. So in fact, I was interviewed on that yesterday in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, St. Paul, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about George Floyd specifically for about 30 minutes interview.
Wow.
So the thing is that, de-escalation is nothing new. It's just not practice. You get it in the academy. Everyone's trained in that. But when they go out in the field, all that training, they put in the locker, lock it up, they create their own approach to things.
So how can people connect with you? I mean, this has been just a treasure trove of information. And I think, anybody who, may have family dealing with the legal system or for FYI, like how can they connect with you?
Well, let's give you my office number. My office number is 213-439-9026. Again, that's 213-439-9026. And if I'm not here, if I'm unavailable, I return all my calls.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
I return all my calls. And I can help guide and direct with regards to that. If you needs, if you have a civil rights issue where you need experts, well, you call our office and we will see about work with your attorney or have your attorney call us, and we will work with the attorney. Also, too, I would encourage everyone to get my book, A Deep Dive, An Expert Analysis of Police Procedure, Use of Force, and Wrongful Conviction. It's on Amazon.com. You can go to my publicity website, which is Tim Williams Jr., S-J-R, timwilliamsjr.com. And you go to, you see it, and you go to the purchase button, and it'll drop you right down to Amazon, and you can purchase it. It's $19.95. And it's 80 pages. It's not a lengthy read, but it's an important read, and it lets you
Absolutely.
Know what's going on within the system, what I'm doing, and what experts like me are should be doing.
I think it's really important for people to understand how the civil and criminal law systems work. I think a lot of people the average person really has no interaction with the legal system. And so, you know, taking the time to read your book is a great use of time, because you never know what could happen, especially in the climate that we're in. It's good to be prepared.
Yeah, you got to be prepared and you got to be knowledgeable. There was a saying that if you want to keep a people ignorant, put it in writing, because they won't read. And I encourage you to read so that you can be informed. And what I'm writing about, you won't find in writing anywheres. And
right.
And this is something that needs to be that the community needs to be aware of.
Absolutely, I'm so excited to go get my copy, and I'm probably going to have to run up to your office and get it signed.
Yeah, come on down.
Once it comes in. Absolutely. Yeah, I think this has been just truly, you know, eye-opening. I mean, for you to, you know, go to almost quit the LAPD to become a nationally renowned expert in wrongful convictions, police procedure, and use of force, that's quite a journey. It's quite a story. And the fact that you have the medical field training that you have, that's amazing as well. And it's like, you know, it doesn't get any better than this. You know, you're listening to the Jazz and Tech Lounge, where we have explored tech, and we've explored the secrets to Tim Williams Jr.'s success. And it definitely has been inspiring for me, because it's easy to get discouraged when you're underestimated and underappreciated, but, you know, some great things still can happen. And thank you for sharing your story with our listeners today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. And I hope that will be inspiration to at least one or two people that will listen to this podcast. And if I am, then my job has been successful.
Well, thank you so much. And until next time.
This is David Spradley, and you're listening to the Jazz and Tech Lounge with Lady Z.
call your mommy, your daddy, and all your friends and tell them New York's number one podcast app is blowing up the airwaves and they can't do nothing about it. Bashani Radio app. We global, baby.
Yeah, baby!
Download free for iPhone and Android in the App Store.